Welcome to the Untoxicated Podcast.
Well, I'm Sherry Salas, and that was my husband, Matt.
We have questions about the impact of alcohol and addiction on relationships.
If you have those kinds of questions, too, you're in the right place.
Here we go. Sherry, you got your hair done recently.
I did.
Looks very nice.
Yeah, it's been, thanks for noticing. It's only been like, you know, I don't know, 9 days.
Well, I didn't just notice this morning.
But I know.
Sometimes when we record these podcasts, little inside baseball, I'm sure no one could ever imagine this. You and I are just not in top form, but you look great.
Thanks.
You did yourself all up nice today.
Did yourself up, man. You sure do look dandy.
So it's not the first time I've noticed, but I'm especially noticing sitting across the microphone from you right now.
Thanks.
You know what? Who really noticed? You said 9 days. When you first got it done, what was the biggest reaction you got? One thing I will say about you, you like to talk about how cheap I am.
I'm also pretty frugal.
Frugal, yeah.
Well, yeah.
So you hadn't had it done in a while.
Yeah, and then the gal at the Cost Cutters that I like quit going because Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursdays are $20 instead of $24.99. But she stopped working. And I was screwed. So, I was pretty impressed. Like, all of our... Well, it's pretty dramatic.
Yeah. It looks great.
Yeah.
Were you about to say?
All of our groups, noticed. The people on our group calls noticed.
Yeah. That's what I noticed. Because obviously I'm not with you all the time, so I don't know other people noticing, but our Echoes of Recovery group, I was shocked at how many people... Like, a couple people would be commenting on how great your hair looked, and then a few more people would join the video call, mm-hmm. and they would be like, oh, look, Sherry, you got your hair done. And
yeah.
So...
Well, a little insider tip on me, and I think there are a lot of people that are like this. Like, when somebody compliments you on your outfit, you can't wait to say, oh, I got it on sale so cheap.
Yeah.
Or I got it at the thrift store. Well, I'm just going to plug. Go into beauty schools. I went to... it's a company called Aveda, and they have a lot of great hair products. And I went to their cosmetology school, and with the instructor,
as a student,
a student cut my hair, but they're instructors. And
go to beauty school yourself?
Yeah, I went to a beauty school to get the hair done.
Yes.
So
you are a willing victim.
Yes.
Nice.
And you definitely block out a longer time for that.
They're cutting each hair individually?
Well, they're...
Kind of feels like it sometimes?
Kind of feels like it, but, it was fine. You had to wait for the instructor to come over and talk and converse. No, but it was great. It was great.
Well, it just struck me how kind and giving people are to each other, especially, I'm gonna go there. There's a gender component to this. The majority of the people in our Echoes of Recovery group are women, and it was the women that were noticing that your hair was done and the women that were quick to dole out compliments.
Well, I'm going to just counter that a moment because I was the one that ran our Monday night, and mostly you run the Monday night shout sobriety calls.
Where
it's mostly men.
Did the dudes notice too?
They noticed.
Oh my
goodness. They noticed.
Way to go, guys.
Yeah.
Well done.
Yeah.
I'm impressed.
So, yeah, I think because it is more dramatic, because I had let it go for a long time, and
yeah.
It was natural color, long most of the time, it was just in a ponytail. It was dramatic enough that people are like, even if they don't notice the hair, they're like, there is something way different.
Well, I just think people are quick to notice and compliment things in each other, especially people that they care about and care for. And quick to be hard on ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's been hitting me pretty hard lately. I've just heard a lot of stories recently about people who are pretty unforgiving about themselves and their own behavior. And so as much, we are our own worst critic, as the cliche goes, but I wish wish people gave themselves as much love as they're willing to give to each other. But I was also really pleased to see all that nice sentiment shared in your direction. It's nice to hear people lifting each other up.
Yeah.
So we are blessed to work with so many people through Echoes of Recovery and Shout Sobriety. And that bond is such that the lifting up goes beyond just giving advice about what do you do about alcoholism. It kind of becomes like family and part of part of the bigger picture of life.
Well, and I think that's why it's important to have a community, you know, that you really resonate with, because you are so bonded and like family, and all they want to do is build each other up and make sure that, you know, that you're feeling good and you're doing well. And
that's right. That's right. Speaking of community, we are blessed to have a huge community of not just folks that are in our groups, but of listeners who have taken our alcoholic intimacy survey. We are still accepting survey results. We are still, the survey is still open. So we want to encourage anyone who hasn't had the chance yet to, from the perspective of the partner of the alcoholic, to give us feedback, help us learn more about how alcoholism has impacted intimacy in your relationship, please go to alcoholicintimacysurvey.org. And there's all the details about what you might be getting yourself into if you take the survey. And we hope you do. We, like I said, we've been thrilled with the response, but we are going to keep it open mostly because I'm not ready to take the next step and do anything with the data yet. So, don't have that window of availability yet.
But it
so
is
still
nice
open
to collect more data, because 100%. Then you have, because, you know, whenever you have, you ever like followed through, like read a survey and you wonder where it kind of comes from, you know, and then you kind of do the research and you realize, oh, well, it was only a survey of 100 people.
Yeah.
And then you're kind of like, well, I would like to see that be a larger number so I feel more confident in the survey.
Yeah.
So I think for me, the way I look at it is like, I think it's great that we're leaving it open for a while. So then people will decide to take it if they haven't already, and just give us larger numbers to really kind of like get this research going and to find this out, because you and I had such hard times finding research and data and help when we were Googling and searching and trying to figure out our post, you know, post-alcoholism, in recovery, well into recovery and sobriety,
right,
relationship issues.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. The more data, the better. Yeah, we hope people will check it out. alcoholicintimacysurvey.org. And thank you to those who have taken it already. Also, speaking of community and the power of community, our listener question today comes from someone from our Echoes of Recovery group. She has a question about blaming the disease. She talks about how her partner, he will occasionally say that he has a little bit of a problem with alcohol, but he is not willing to admit that he has an addiction, is definitely not willing to admit that his alcoholism is a disease. And so her question is, how am I supposed... So she's spent a lot of time educating herself and learning and you know, she's buying into and being supported by the things that we're sharing. And one of the things that we talk about is it's so, so, so helpful to recovery when you can blame the bad behavior and the bad decisions and all the chaos and the trauma, when you can blame that on the disease, when you can blame it on the alcohol. And so I think she's... Well, obviously, if he's not even admitted that he is officially an alcoholic, she's well ahead of him on her recovery. She's done a lot of work. And so her question is, how am I supposed to blame the disease and blame the alcohol when he swears he doesn't have a disease? So she's getting conflicting messages from what she's done to get better and learn versus the gaslighting that she's receiving from her alcoholic. What advice do you have for her?
Well, it kind of makes me think of some of the earlier times when you were deciding whether or not you had an alcohol use disorder, or you just binge drank, or, you know, how it was. So I guess when I would frame it in that context, whatever she feels his relationship is to alcohol. You can still blame the alcohol. Whether he wants to admit that he has an addiction or it's a disease he has or however he wants to state that, you can still blame the alcohol by saying the alcohol is making you act in these ways or making you do this or you're hungover. And so these are things that don't happen the next day with us as a family because you're hungover or you're snappy because you're anxious about drinking. So I feel like you can still blame the alcohol. And you went through many years of trying to blame everything but the alcohol.
Yeah.
So I kind of feel like you can do that. Now, you don't have to, like, I kind of gave up trying to say, oh, you have a problem with alcohol. I just, you know, in my mind said, the alcohol is doing this. We've tried everything else, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't even have to really share it with your partner who you think is the addict either. I mean, you can just say those statements. Well, you were really hungover yesterday morning, and so therefore the lawn didn't get mowed, so I'm hiring the neighbor kid to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, pointing in the direction of and pointing it back to the alcohol, the tangible things might be a bit of an eye-opener, but you don't have to say it in a cruel way.
Yeah.
That points a finger in shame.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that our listener has done a lot of work on her own recovery, and she's making progress, and she's found community, and she's doing all the things. Part of her work in recovery, and this is something we talk about all the time in Echoes, and we talk about often on the podcast, is learning to listen to your instincts and ignore your insecurities. And so him saying, I don't have a disease, what are you talking about? I'm not an alcoholic. Stop talking like that. That is playing on her insecurities. And so I think part of her work in recovery is to continuing to pursue ignoring those insecurities and just believing what she knows to be true. You know, if you're looking right at it and you can see it and you can touch it and you can identify it, then don't let it, the thing you're looking at, try to fool you.
Mm-hmm.
Believe what you're seeing and what her partner says, her work in recovery is continuing to work toward trying to disregard what he says when he's gaslighting and denying.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think, like, that is also, like, if they were to say, you know, like I gave the example of the lawn being mowed, and so then a few days later I had to hire the neighbor kid to do it. That's putting the blame, you know, there on the disease, but it's also, like, verbalizing out loud your truth and what you see, because so many times we get shut down. Does that make sense?
Yeah, of course.
You know, so like verbalizing it out loud to your partner saying, well, you were too hungover to mow the lawn on Saturday and Sunday. It's Wednesday. I'm hiring the neighbor kid. You know, not that you're incompetent and you can't do it, but, you know, or I'm doing it myself.
Yeah.
You know, but to say your truth out loud to them, which takes a lot of courage, I think. And a lot of guts, because we also feel so insecure about our own reality. But speaking your truth out loud is, I just think, a good way to kind of give you that sort of self-confidence, too.
Speaking of insecurity, I'm really glad that I mowed the lawn last weekend. 2 weeks earlier than normal. Normally it's, I don't know why it always is, but I always mow it on Kentucky Derby weekend, the first Saturday in May, but it was scraggly, and I'm glad I did it, because if you had given this example a couple, two, three times, I would have felt really secure. In fact, I'm standing up to look at it. Yeah, it looks fine.
To see if I've, like, noticed something.
Yeah. Hmm. I don't know if there's something wrong, but no, it is a really good example. You know, in addition to insecurities and instincts, another just super common topic, something that we spend a lot of time on, is boundaries. And it's important for everyone who is going to do boundary work to recognize that when they set a boundary, when anyone sets a boundary on either side of alcoholism, anyone can have boundaries about what behavior that they find acceptable and how they feel like they deserve to be treated, just what they're going to be willing to put up with. It's important when doing boundary work to recognize that the boundary is not a punishment of the other people around you. A boundary is setting a standard, a minimum standard of behavior that you're willing to accept. And so if you, for instance, Sherry, set a boundary that you are going to live in a house where the lawn gets mowed every week, I can either mow it or you can mow it. Or you can make the kids mow it, or you can find someone else to mow it.
Yeah, why do you have kids? You gotta have them mow the lawn. But
if that's your boundary, that's not necessarily a punishment on me. That's just the minimum acceptable thing that you desire in your life. And so boundary work is, it's really confusing because it's one of these like easy hard things, right? Mm-hmm. When you explain, okay, yeah, that makes sense. I'm in. But then when you start to do it, if the boundary that you set makes the person that you're in partnership with uncomfortable or they don't like it, then here comes the gaslighting, right? Oh, you're just trying to control me. You're trying to make me do this. You're trying to make me do that. No, I'm not trying to control you. I'm setting a standard for what I'm willing to accept in my life. You can participate in that or not, but that's where I am. And obviously, you know, if you don't have some big traumatic, relationship straining incident or series of incidents happening in your life, like for instance, alcoholism, if you don't have that, you might go through your whole adult life and never have to get into the weeds on this boundary discussion. But if you have experienced alcoholism and you are the loved one, you are the partner, and you get to the point where you're saying, I'm not going to live like this anymore, and you start to set boundaries, then if the alcoholic in your life doesn't like your boundaries, that's a really, really good sign. Because change only happens when we feel pain. And if the alcoholic doesn't feel pain from your boundaries, then they are very unlikely to make any kind of change. Does that all make sense?
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's one boundary specifically that I think we should talk about. It's been on my mind quite a bit lately. And I want to start with a little bit of a story. When I got sober, and as we've discussed, there were lots of times in our relationship, in our marriage, where I tried sobriety and then I would go back to drinking and tried sobriety and would go back to drinking. And so there was a 10-year period of that little ping pong, that mental gymnastics. But this last time, so a little over 7 years ago now, when I got sober for the final time, one of the things I did pretty quickly was sit down with each of our kids. This wasn't the big, powerful conversation we had with them when they got to share their resentments and share how my drinking had made them feel. It wasn't even close to something as good or important as that. But I sat down with each of them individually and explained my addiction and explained why alcohol was bad for me, and just really kind of spoke to them in a way that a father often speaks to their kids. But, you know, it was here I am. I'm the one with all the knowledge, and I'm going to impart this knowledge on my kids, and you need to sit and listen and understand and learn from me because I'm your father. And what I later learned was how excruciatingly challenging that was, especially for our oldest kids, to sit there and listen to me talk like that, because it was my alcoholism, my moral failing, you know, certainly in their eyes, my lack of fulfilling the responsibilities as a parent when I was drinking, that was what had caused all the trauma and chaos. And so who the hell do I think I am to then sit there and lecture them each on the dangers of alcohol and the dangers of addiction and what I had gone through? That was very, very painful for them. Like I said, especially the older two. And I had no idea. So the boundary that I want to talk about is around giving advice for us alcoholics when we are in active addiction or in early sobriety to the people around us, especially the people in that nuclear family, the partner and the kids. And one of the, I don't know, what's the right word? One of the, you know, side effects, I think that's a good word. One of the side effects of getting sober and starting your recovery is, we've talked about this, you spend a lot of time learning and researching and in group work and learning about recovery nutrition and learning about neurotransmitters. And so you're getting kind of overwhelmed by this knowledge, this important knowledge. It's important to do that. I'm not poo-pooing that at all. It's important to dive in, because if you don't, you'll relapse. At least I would have. And I did before. If you don't do all the work and do all the things, and, you know, if you're an AA person, 100 meetings in 100 days, I think, is one of the things they talk about. Whatever you set for your program of recovery, if you don't dive in head first all the way, the chances of relapse are really high, and your chances of successful sobriety long term are really low. So you got to do that. But then taking all that knowledge and imparting that on your family, listen to what I learned. Listen to what I learned. I don't think we have the right to do that. And I think it behooves us as the former alcoholics to stay away from that kind of behavior. So I want to get your reaction. When I first got sober, I would learn stuff and I'd come and tell you what I learned and just kind of beat you down about it. Like, oh, you got to listen to this, Sherry. How did that feel for you?
Well, I'll try to use a kind sort of thing. I would often think in my head, oh, big fucking deal. Who gives a
That's
shit?
That's your kind sort of thing?
That would have been like, I said in my head, I would think that. And I would be like, oh, well, that's really interesting. But then the more that happened, I just really had to try to, like, take it with, you know, with the intent that it was given, that you're learning this. And I'm like, well, yeah, I knew that, or I understood that, or yeah, that makes sense. You don't need to come and tell me about it. But I finally had to say, I can't listen to all that you are learning, because for one, I didn't respect your opinion. So I really didn't want you to tell me anything.
That's the
key. Had told me so much shit over the years that were, this is the reason that I'm drinking, or this is the reason I'm not drinking. Or, you know, we kind of went through a litany of really bad things that you thought were the cause or the reasons. And, you know, and your ideas mostly fell flat for a really, really long time.
Right.
And so I didn't have any respect or desire to listen to your nonsense, even if it was coming from a book. I mean, I think there was one book that you and I kind of read together that introduced that, like, the binge drinking versus, like, the full-on addiction, and it kind of talked about the brain chemistry just slightly, and it was kind of that introduction. But other than that, I felt like, God, I don't want to hear it.
Yeah.
I can't hear it. Because how is it going to, is this going to stick?
Is part of that based on the fact that, so you, especially at that stage, you didn't really understand addiction. And all you knew was, if you didn't want to drink, you just didn't drink.
Yeah.
And if you didn't want to drink for months or years, you just didn't drink for months or years. There was nothing making you drink. And so when I would have to do all this research and all this learning and changes of patterns and behaviors, do all this stuff to just do this one simple thing that you could do without batting an eye, which is not drink, was that also kind of a loss of respect? You're like, just...
Oh, no, I... You're right. I didn't understand it. And I wouldn't say I thought it was a weakness or a moral failing, or I just thought, don't you have so many other good things going on in your life that you're now choosing to drink? Like, I just felt like it was selfish.
Yeah.
It was just a selfishness, I guess, more than anything.
Yeah.
Would be the best way to describe. Because I was like, if I'm asking you not to drink because I think it's going to make the house better, but you can't do it, that's just you being selfish.
Yeah.
And wanting what you want, because I felt like in the relationship for many years that you just got what you wanted all the time. because of the alcohol, whether it was whisper fighting or giving in to sex because you wanted it or whatever. So I felt like I didn't have a voice and you always got what you want. And then, of course, that turns to everything, right? Because you kind of just get in that mindset. Oh, Matt gets whatever he wants. So that's how I looked at drinking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because you wanted it all. You wanted everything that you wanted. Again, it wasn't because I thought you had a moral failing.
Well, that's really interesting because the two ways alcohol impacts the drinker, the me, the ways it impacted me, the two were, first of all, you know, when I wanted to drink, when I thought it was my right to drink, when it was time, when it was the weekend, when it was time to drink, when it was after work, whatever, nothing would stand in my way because of the pull of the addiction, the craving of the addiction. So you're right. If it was one of the rare occasions when we were going out to dinner, I would demand that it was a place that had a liquor license, mm-hmm. because it was my God-given right to drink. And so you're right. I get my way. I am the kind of force that's driving everything because of that pull for drinking. And then the other way that it impacts it is once I've got alcohol in my system, now I'm just selfish because alcoholics are selfish. I mean, that's just part of the disease, right? So there's alcohol in my system. So any concern that I might have had in a sober state of mind about your well-being or your desires or the kids or anyone else around us, that's just out the window. That's part of how the toxicity of alcohol warps our brain function. I would argue that most people who are drinking, whether they're alcoholics or not, pretty concerned about number one and mm-hmm. nobody else once alcohol's in their system. So yeah, you were getting it from all fronts. When I'm not drinking, but it's getting close to time to drink, I'm selfish. And then once I'm drinking, I'm 100% selfish.
Yeah.
Yeah. Excellent point. When we talk about this boundary around giving advice, I think, you know, there are two things. We have to separate this into two areas. One is the one that we've been talking about. I'm learning about me. I'm learning about my disease. I'm learning stuff that's necessary for me to maintain recovery. You kind of don't really care. You're not all that interested. Maybe you listen sometimes, maybe you don't. But it's just not on the top of your list, and I get kind of annoying. So that's one thing. But it gets really bad when I start learning things, right, and telling you how you need to live your life. Mm-hmm. And there's a story that we've shared in the past, but I know this is at the in your top five list of things I've ever done that really, really set you off. But we were returning from vacation once, and I'll let you tell it because you'll remember it better than me. But I started talking about nutrition and not eating processed foods. And what was I blaming the processed foods for the dysfunction in our relationship? And you got real mad.
Well, I feel like that has happened often. I remember stories of that in the car and on an airplane.
Oh, okay. Great.
Are you speaking of the one on the airplane?
Speak about whichever one you want. It was your anger and frustration.
Well, anytime. It happened so often because anytime we went on vacation, and I'm saying vacation with air quotes, family trips are not vacation.
Yeah.
These were family trips, but it was the only time that you and I...
Wait. Let's clarify. When we say family trips, we're taking our family to see more of our family.
Yes. That's what I was going to clarify.
Sorry.
We owned a business. No, you're fine. We owned a business that we didn't take time away from the business. We were all hands on deck. So when we did take time away, we wanted to make sure that our children, who didn't live in the same states as their extended family, got to see their family. So we took a trip in May to Indiana to see my family and some friends and go to the Indianapolis 500. And then we made a trip to go see your family that all met at your parents' house in South Carolina.
Right. And that was usually
so
July.
Like May and July.
Yeah.
And then the rest of the time, we were locked in to our house in Denver.
Right.
You know, no other. And we had people that came to visit us. But because we were in an environment with those sort of vacation modes and it's, you know, Memorial Day weekend, so there's burgers and brats and those sort of things, and drinking, and not the healthiest eating is going on there. And your family, I wouldn't... It's weird. Your family is slim, but they really eat really shitty a lot of times. Snack-wise.
Okay. Lots of carbs. And so,
lots of carbs. Lots of empty carbs. So both of those vacations, you would always come away with, oh, well, it's because I ate all this junk food. You never once wanted to admit it was because my family didn't have access to alcohol the way you had at your family. Most of my family doesn't drink, so you had to be the one to go and buy it.
Yeah.
So.
Which I never hesitated to do.
Right.
Sometimes I would get so frustrated because your family lives in a small town in southern Indiana, and there's one liquor store in town, and it was not cheap. So yeah. Sometimes I would stock up on the way into town, either bring it with us all the way from Colorado or stock up in, I think, in a bigger town on the way in, and just roll in like the drunk I was with the cases of beer.
Yeah, and we even had coolers. Yeah, coolers that you kept chilled in the car or in the garage away from, you know, my mom seeing because she doesn't have the one refrigerator. So, yeah, so those times you were definitely going to take advantage of the vacation time and not working. So you drank a lot, but you always walked away from these family trips / vacation feeling bad. And then you would try to blame it on, oh, the terrible food we were eating, all the excess carbs that were out. Because we had, like, at your family, there are seven kids total. So there was all kinds of chips and snacks.
But I turned it not only about the food that we had on vacation, I turned it into we need to not have any processed food at our house. That's the part that really, really aggravated you.
Yeah, so we were on our way home, and you're like, I really think that the processed food's what's really dragging me down. I feel like shit from what we ate all week. I think we need to be clean eaters. We need to get all the processed food out of the house. We will no longer have this. We will no longer have that. And it was all based on the way you were feeling.
Right.
And the excess that you did. But you didn't want to point the finger at, yeah, you can eat like crap and feel crappy at the end of the weekend. Doesn't mean you carry it over into the rest of your life. Because for the most part, we didn't have a whole lot of processed foods at our house.
My recollection is that it wasn't just me talking about me going to do something different for me.
It was all about we.
Isn't that what infuriated you?
Yeah.
That's the whole family's going to have to change the way we eat now.
Yeah. We need to get rid of the processed food. We need to do this. And then it flat out came, and you need to not buy this stuff at the grocery store. And I was like, well, what do I buy at the grocery store that's causing all these problems at home? Like, these, you know, so you're like, make your own tomato sauce. What the fuck? Make your own tomato. Do you know how hard that is? Like, pasta sauce. I buy the one already with zero sugar most of the time. Like, and tomatoes have a little sugar. So it was like, oh, and then you have to read labels. No added sugar. No this. No that. No, you know. Oh, my God. Yeah.
Yeah. So.
So the you then became we. Then became me.
Yeah.
I was going to be the one that has to do all the work to try to take care of your fucking problem.
Yeah. Well, I don't have to ask if that irritated you, because it sounds like it still does.
Well, I mean, it just added up, right? Like, yeah. you weren't the one doing the cooking and going to the grocery store.
Yeah. And
I'm not being sexist. It was just my choice, because I prefer to cook.
But the point here is, and I think you're making it very well, is, you know, and I was not sober at that time. But when we do get sober, or when we're in active addiction and we start giving the people around us advice about how they should live their life, we just don't have the right to do that. When we've created all this chaos and trauma, that's not going to be received well.
Yeah.
I mean, it's infuriating when the person that's making the environment that we live in unsafe starts coming up with things that the other people in that environment need to fix and change about themselves. Isn't that fair to say?
Yeah, because we look at you like you're the one that's been screwing everything up for years.
Yeah.
So why are you, why do you think that we give a shit what you say? We don't believe what you say. We hold everything that you are spewing out with a grain of salt. Like, we really have to think, is this even logical? Does it make sense? And it has to run through a filter.
Yeah.
And it just seems so disrespectful to the rest of the people in the house that have been trying to do the right thing.
Right.
And have to walk around on eggshells and pretend this didn't happen and behave this certain way. And then here you are coming in with your rules and what we as a family need to do. And I'm like, who even thinks that we care enough about what you say, drunk? I mean, that's sometimes what I would think. God, you're just a drunk. Who really cares what you think?
Can you think of any other examples where I did that besides the whole processed food thing? Where I said, here's something I've learned, or here's something I believe, and we all need to do this, or Sherry, you need to do this.
Well,
what's another example?
I think it is healthy. If it is very healthy, but we weren't at a point where we could really do it. It was being a lot more like open and communicative about what's really irritating, because I am a pusher down. Mm-hmm. You know, I often didn't bring things up because I didn't want to stir the pot.
Sure. So those eggshells you were walking on, like you said.
So, like, forcing vulnerability?
Mm-hmm. Great example.
And then a few times I did, and then it backfired.
How did it backfire?
Well, this is kind of specific. It was the night before Easter, and I shared with you a scenario that happened in my teenage years, and it pissed you off, and you decided that drinking more was going to help that.
Of course.
Scenario, right? Because it's nothing you could do, it's nothing you could fix. You couldn't have sympathy for what happened. You just had anger and were mad at somebody that you didn't even know. And, I mean, you never blamed me for it. But then, as the drinking went on, it became, well, this is why you behave this way, because of that. Well, I mean, yes, it probably affects it, but the accusatory way it played out made it seem like it was my fault, and I just need to erase that from my memory bank, and I need to just move forward.
As is the case for the majority of females when you reach adulthood, there has been some kind of inappropriate sexual thing done to you, a near miss, a full-on assault, a bad situation, and so this was something like that.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, it just, then it became like, you know, then it kind of became, well, you need to work on this, and you need to just, like, get over it. And then, you know, of course it was drunk gibberish, but it was that back and forth. Like, somehow, it's my fault that I've carried in these feelings into the adult part of my life, but I need to rectify it. And you aren't going to be supportive, and you aren't going to help me, or I couldn't, you were very obstinate about me getting a therapist. But I had to somehow figure out how to just get over it.
Yeah, so...
And it became my fault.
Ugh. Such a terrible thing for me to put you through. One of the very, very common things that happens is the relationship is not going well. I'm not willing to blame the alcohol, because I'm still actively drinking. So I'm not willing to blame the alcohol for the relationship distress. You share something, you get vulnerable... which was at the time a very rare occasion. You share something very deeply personal and painful, and I have this light bulb moment, this aha, that's it. That's why we can't get along. That's why everything's fucked up. So Sherry, you need to drop everything and dedicate your life to fixing this problem, because if you fix this problem, it'll fix all the other problems. Again, all the while ignoring the impact alcohol is having on the relationship. Because I can't go there, because if I go there, I got to stop drinking.
Yeah, and I mean, we were just supposed to be filling the Easter eggs for the Easter baskets and then for the Easter egg hunt that next morning. But you just weren't content with it being the night before Easter, we'd have to get up a little earlier than normal because the kids were going to do an Easter egg hunt at the house before we went to church services, you know? And you weren't getting what you wanted because we weren't going to have, you know, sex downstairs while we're doing... I'm not in that mindset.
Yeah.
You know, I'm filling eggs for the kids, being the Easter bunny.
Yeah. Ugh. I'm really disgusted with myself.
Ugh. Sorry.
Yeah, no, nothing to be sorry about. I appreciate your honesty. I think that's a perfect example of what we're talking about when it comes to boundaries about giving advice. The two that we've shared personally were when I was still actively drinking. This is also something that happens and is very painful in sobriety and early sobriety. The example that I gave with, you know, trying to lecture to the kids, yeah. That was a sobriety one. So it can happen in, you know, anywhere in the recovery or lack thereof kind of system. So,
well, and I think that we maybe didn't have as many incidences in this sobriety attempt because we had already done 10 years of working through the kinks and I was pretty detached at this point.
Yeah.
And I had already made it pretty damn clear, like, I don't care what you do at 5 o'clock when you get home. Just fucking do whatever you want, but stay away from me.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't say those words, but I certainly put off that presence. Like,
right.
No, I'm not here to, you can go read and you just stay reading and just stay out of the kitchen, stay out of where I am at, like making dinner. Don't come in and converse with me.
Yeah. So a couple of pretty common things that we hear. One is, you know, kind of around the area of spirituality, learning about human growth, making progress, things like that. When the alcoholic in that early sobriety period starts to really make some progress and, you know, learn the things that they've in their mind been closed off to for all the active addiction years, they bring that to the family and say, well, you know, it's not just me who needs to do this. We all need to do this. Meditation is one that comes to mind.
Mm-hmm.
I know we've heard many, many stories about an alcoholic gets sober and part of their program is meditation. I can't say enough good things about how great that is. If that helps you to stay sober, to meditate, to work on your breathing, to get to a peaceful place where you're locked into the present and you're not stressed about the past or worried about the future, like, that's great. So don't misunderstand. I am all for, if meditation's your thing, go meditate. If yoga's your thing, go yoga. If going to AA meetings is your thing and talking with your group there, that's great. Go do that. If praying is your thing, if having a deeper understanding of your purpose on earth is your thing, all of that is wonderful. But don't go to your spouse and tell your spouse that she needs to meditate or yoga or become a better person or think about their purpose on earth. You don't have the right. That's crossing a boundary, whether that is a boundary that has been set and spoken by the partner of the alcoholic or not. I can tell you from what we've learned, that is, you're going into a bad place. If you start after the chaos and trauma that your alcoholism and your decision to drink has created, if you start telling the people around you how to become better humans because they need to be more in touch with something, you're going to a bad place.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you think?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what it is about people in recovery that want to share that because they don't realize the lack of respect and I guess respect is the only thing,
right?
Yeah, and I guess respect is the only thing that is the right word to describe the lack of respect that we have for your opinion and what you have to say. Is not that we don't love you or care about you, but you've just let us down so many times.
Yeah.
And you've let yourself down so many times in attempts to recovery. And because it works for you, doesn't mean it's going to work for everyone. And that, you know, that's why I think there are so many recovery and sobriety options out there. Because one doesn't, you know, if one doesn't work, try on another one. But I just guess the lack of respect, like that dumbfoundedness that alcoholics in sobriety, they don't understand. So I'll just say it again. We don't respect what you have to say because you've fucked us over so many times with your other words. And it just becomes just another layer. And I feel like it's almost like a defense mechanism. Like, well, meditation is working for me, so it must work for everybody. And they have to drag everybody into their problem and their problem solving. And maybe it's that lack of self-esteem or individuality that is missing.
Well, let me speak to that, because it, as wrong as it is for me, as I'm getting sober, to tell you how to live your life, it's for once, it's not from a place of selfishness. It's not meant to harm. It's not really gaslighting. It comes from a place of purity, at least in my experience. And I think this is probably universal. Something is helping me and I want it to help you too. It really is a generous thing. We just don't understand that, you know, we're not, this would be like, I've got a great idea that I want to share with the President of the United States, but he won't take my phone call. Yeah. He, guess what? Your partner's not taking your phone call right now. Doesn't matter how great your idea is. For all the reasons that you have just shared, you have, you've lost the right. You've lost the right to share your opinion about how others should live their lives until you spend some serious time in that recovery process, re-earning trust. Not just rebuilding trust, but re-earning trust. Once you've re-earned some trust, then perhaps your opinion will be welcome again.
Or maybe we see
the opinion doesn't come. It's not negative to have the thoughts that, hey, this is really helping me. I bet it could help the people around me. For once, the thoughts are coming from a place of a good place, a place of semi-purity, I guess. But it's the timing's just off. That's not your place. It's not your place to share your opinion about how other people should live their lives at that point.
Yeah. And maybe keep in mind, as you really want to share this good thing that's working for you, that you've only been doing it a short time. And we've seen that over and over. I'm going to have this rule for drinking, and this is going to solve all the problems. And then that lasts for a little bit. So, pardon me, making sure that we can see the evidence of what you're doing is working, and then maybe our curiosity will spike. Or you've been doing it for quite a while. And quite a while to an alcoholic in early sobriety.
About 45 minutes.
Yes. It's a lot different than what their partner's, which is like 45 days, 45 months, 45 years. So, I mean, I think that's one of those situations where, and I'm going to use, this is an old saying that our kids used to say, was you do you. And I used to kind of be offended by that because, of course, it coming out of a teenager's mouth. Well, you do you. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, you do you. But as I've analyzed it, it is kind of like, well, this is what I need to do to stay healthy. Mm-hmm. This is what works for me to stay healthy, sober, you know, just, you know, detached, all that. But then you can't enforce what works for you on others. So we do kind of have to, you do you, I do me. And then after a while, say a year, 18 months, maybe you come together and say, well, what's working for you? Or I've noticed this. Because then hopefully alcohol has taken away some of the eggshells, or having no alcohol, yeah, like sobriety, taking away some of those eggshells that you're walking around on, and the fearfulness, and there's been no relapses, and you're starting to earn that trust back, and then that can be an open door of communication where maybe you could share.
Yeah. The best thing that we can do, sorry.
I was just going to add, but the thing that you can't do is have just unbalanced behavior. You can't be manic, you know, and depressive. You can't just be up and down all across the board, because we've got people who have partners in sobriety that they're just all over the place all the time, up and down, and one little thing sets them off. You have to be consistently well-behaved.
Mm-hmm. Create that consistent safety.
Yes, before we also, like, want to tap into what you're doing.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, we talk a lot about how before you can actually do relationship recovery, each individual in the relationship needs to get stronger, healthier, increase their self-esteem. And so that individual recovery, that certainly was the case for me and you. It was when we focused on ourselves each individually and we got strong as separate people that the relationship, because we were just more resilient. We had more self-esteem. We felt better about ourselves. I was able to do resentment processing. I was able to hear all the bad things that were still haunting you and that you needed to I needed to share the burden with you of carrying those memories. And so when you've got a good idea, when you've got a practice that's working, when meditation is just your jam and it's going great, just keep doing it. And so to your point, you start to show the example of how this is having a positive impact on your life. And maybe the other person gets curious and asks about it. It's not unlike parenting late teens and young 20s. Mm-hmm. Like you reach the point where they don't want your advice anymore. But if you create a safe relationship where you're not always telling them what to do, but they feel comfortable conversing with you, then maybe they come to you and ask for your opinion once in a while. Mm-hmm. And that's where you can, you know, leverage your many, many years of life experience to their advantage. But, you know, there are just situations in life where you can't just tell people what you think they should do. Another one besides the like, you know, meditative practices, yoga, mindfulness, all of that, the personal growth category, you know, it's very common to talk about childhood experiences, ACEs, adverse childhood experiences. We've all got them. Some of us have more than the others. And I'm really glad from the mental health community that this is a topic that's getting a lot of attention now. It's really important that people consider how what they went through in childhood has impacted how they behave and how they feel as adults, because it gives you an opportunity to address behaviors that you're not happy with and figure out the origin so that you can figure out the solution. But this is another area where we don't have the right to go there. And this is a place that I went to often. I would say things to you, Sherry, like, oh, you know, your dad was an alcoholic and that's why you behave the way you do. Or, you know, your mom, she's got a temper and that's why, you know, and so that temper filtered down or whatever. And the things that you went through as a kid, those are the reasons that you are creating this distress in our relationship that makes it so we can't get along. And so you need to go address your thing. Mm-hmm. As someone who has gone through active addiction, created all this chaos and trauma in a relationship, I don't have the right to say that. What was that like for you when I would point to things in your family background as opposed to things in my family background, when I would contrast the two and say, oh, here's the reason that you've got the problems you've got. You need to go work on this.
Well, I thought it was ironic because now you really appreciate therapy. But at the time when you would be spewing those things, you were very opposed to me seeing a therapist.
You need to work on this, but work on it by yourself. Like, how's that going to go?
Just forget about it. Put it in the past. Like, that was sort of your thing. Like, put it in the past.
Tell a stuffer to stuff harder.
Yeah.
That's smart.
So then I'll explode on you one day. So I thought it was very hilarious to think about that now, you know. At the time, I thought, yeah, my family wasn't perfect. Nobody, I mean, and you hadn't really even admitted a lot of the things. And it's not like you had big T trauma things in your upbringing, but in the early stages, you wouldn't divulge any of the bad stuff. You wanted to make it seem like your family upbringing had been fairly idyllic and perfect. And that's what I thought from the outset. And I had said that to you, you know, but you also blamed.
I didn't divulge it because I couldn't see it.
Yeah. So, you know, it would be, oh, your father's an alcoholic, your parents are divorced, they just gave up too easily, you know, mm-hmm. those sort of things. Or, you know, and I thought, yeah, everybody's family is not perfect, that's for sure. But how does, I understand it shapes me, but it also makes me want to do things differently, too. So there is a positive side to that sort of stuff, mm-hmm. you know? So I thought, you're not just seeing that I'm not running away. I might threaten divorce, but I wasn't, you knew that was an empty threat. I wasn't going anywhere. Back in those earlier days.
Yeah.
Is when I stopped, you know, sharing or caring or and being emotionally connected or didn't take the bait in arguing with you. And that's when I think you got worried because you're like, oh, so.
But you had to make a transition from when I would say stuff like that, you would wear it hard.
Yeah.
And be like, yeah, that hurts that he said that. That was mean. But maybe my father's alcoholism is the cause of my whatever. So
wanting better out of my husband and out of the father of my children.
I mean, you're so, very yes, strong and intelligent and you're very aware of what gaslighting is and isn't now. But there was a time when you bought it.
Yeah.
Right? You bought what I was selling.
Yeah. And I mean, like I said, maybe it was, yeah, my dad was an alcoholic, so I want a lot better out of you. So maybe that was, I mean, I don't think it was adversely affecting, but it was affecting. And maybe you took it like I was being feisty. I never really bought into the, I'm going to think you're an alcoholic, Matt, because my dad was an alcoholic. Because I didn't grow up around him.
You didn't buy that shit I was shoveling
up. I didn't buy that one. I never bought the one, oh, I married an alcoholic because I wanted to fix him. I married you because some of the things that were red flags early on weren't as, you know, they were kind of, we've talked about this, kind of normalized in my family. But it wasn't because I was like set out to fix you or that's where I felt like I needed and what I deserved. So, I'm trying to think of like other things that, yeah, I think my mom's temper and her helplessness and her anger that she felt in a lot of ways did affect me and made me kind of feel like that. And I didn't have a great example of that because she played victim mode and anger a lot. And so that really affected me.
So we're describing this as a boundary. And so I want to get to how this played out for you. You detached in a natural way. You didn't detach because you read it in a book or because a therapist told you. You detached because you were done. You had taken all you could take and you didn't have any interest in the things I had to say anymore. And you had lost respect for me, as you've said. And so you got to this point where my words stopped impacting you to a great degree. And you started to more or less blow me off. And so you got to the point where, you know, you were able to establish a boundary about what you were willing to receive from me. So mm-hmm. I could say stuff that you need to look into your childhood and you need to do this and this, and it would just bounce right off. Mm-hmm. But you came by that naturally. And it took time.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if the boundary, if it became for you a process of detachment, what it looks like for the drinker is almost to set our own self boundary to limit saying things that are going to disgust you because of the lack of respect you have for me. So the boundary goes both ways. As the drinker in sobriety, one of the best things I could have done, and I think it, to some extent I eventually did, well, I know I eventually did it, but one of the best things I could do is stop offering that advice because I've recognized that not only is it falling on deaf ears, which is part of that detachment that I talked about, but it's also really painful and aggressive for someone to offer that kind of advice when that person, their drinking is what has created all the problems to begin with. So I just think it would, for the drinkers out there that are listening to this, that you can set a self boundary. This is not just something that is to be imposed on you by your partner. If you can recognize that your advice is not only not welcome, but it's causing more damage, mm-hmm. and learn to curtail that, it will really help with long-term relationship recovery. Yeah.
Yeah. Makes sense. Yeah. Cause I mean, when I'm thinking of, because you've never been short on words, our whole relationship, there was always, and your brain is always going, there was always a plan. There was always movement that were going on. There was always a forward thinking. There was always another step, another rule, another option. And then you had to kind of learn, oh, well, this is just pushing her further and further away. And you didn't realize, because I didn't verbalize, I have no respect for you. But you could sense that you're like, wow, you know, it is really pushing her away. Because I think that it just makes it just made me keep like thinking, is he ever just going to take care of what he needs to do, mm-hmm. instead of involving everybody else?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm sure glad you waited around until I figured that out. Only took me a smidge over a bunch of decades or whatever it was. So hopefully people that are listening to this will move a little faster than you and I did through the relationship recovery process and the individual recovery process.
Yeah, and definitely don't be afraid to look into a variety of things that work for you. If you have childhood trauma, if you have ACEs, if you've had, you know, look into that, work on that. But you don't have to tell your partner to do the same.
Yeah. And the partners out there, very helpful for you to look into it as well. You know, you're probably not going to if that advice
put it in shame and blame terms.
Yeah, exactly. You need to fix this. This is what's wrong with our relationship.
You know, yeah.
But we can all do a little self-introspection work. And hopefully we can do that without increasing the degree to which we are our own worst enemy. Hopefully we can look in the mirror after coming back from the beauty school and be proud of what we see. Looking in the mirror and being proud of what you see all the time should be kind of the goal, don't you think?
Mm-hmm.
Awesome.
Absolutely.
Before you go, we hope you'll consider these three resources.
If you love or loved an alcoholic, we offer support and connection in our Echoes of Recovery group. Check us out at echoesofrecovery.org.
If you are a high-functioning alcoholic seeking methods and connection in early sobriety, we're ready for you at shoutsobriety.org.
No matter who you are, there's something for you in our book, Sober Evolution, Evolve into Sobriety and Recover Your Alcoholic Marriage. Go to soberevolution.org.
For my wife, Sherry Salas, I'm Matt Salas. Thanks for listening to the Untoxicated Podcast.